I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a conversation with now Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman. But first, leading Republican William Kristol today called for John McCain to fire his campaign. Once merely problematic, Kristol writes, the McCain campaign is now close to being out-and-out dysfunctional. Slipping in the polls and the subject of media dissection all weekend because of attacks from his backers on Barack Obama, John McCain does seem to be trying today to at least restart his campaign.
We have 22 days to go. We're 6 points down. Senator Obama is measuring the drapes and planning with Speaker Pelosi and Senator Reid to raise taxes, increase spending. But you know what they forgot? They forgot to let you decide. My friends, we've got them just where we want them.
McCain and running mate Sarah Palin spoke at a campaign event in Virginia, a southern battleground state that's voted for Republican presidents since 1964, but which polls show Barack Obama is now leading by 6 percentage points. Barack Obama will be speaking today as well on the economy. Joining us on the line is Holly Bailey, who's covered the McCain campaign. And Holly, to McCain's appearance today, he repeatedly said, "I have a plan on the economy." Was this, did this seem to you like a relaunch of his campaign?
I think the speech was striking, and in some ways, yes. But, you know, the thing that was striking to me about the speech is, you know, it was passionate again. You know, Senator McCain has been on the stump and sort of been delivering these, you know, sort of negative attacks against Barack Obama, and he hasn't done it with much enthusiasm. And hearing him today and reading the words of the speech, it's sort of been turned it back to where he sort of was in the primary, in which he was talking more about himself and sort of selling himself to the American people. You know, what I think that there's still going to be a lot of pressure on Senator McCain to sort of tell more specifics on what exactly his plans are if he is president. But, you know, it's just striking to me he didn't really attack Senator Obama that much in this speech. It was more just about him. And I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what the kind of speeches are from here on now to the election day.
Well, what does it tell us as well about what's going on inside the campaign? We remember last week McCain held open mic events in which his backers urged him to go at Obama. Some yelled, "Kill him." Speakers called Obama a Muslim, an Arab, a terrorist, all false. Leading black congressman and former civil rights activist John Lewis to compare the tone of the McCain campaign to George Wallace's incendiary speeches just before the Birmingham church bombings in 1963. So is there a feeling inside the campaign that these outbursts against Obama are hurting John McCain?
I think definitely, yes. I mean, that's why I think you saw John McCain come out on Friday in Wisconsin at a town hall and specifically start defending Barack Obama. A woman said, "I'm not going to vote for him because he's Arab." And he took the microphone away from her and defended Barack Obama. He said, "You know, you shouldn't be scared if he's elected. He's actually a decent man. And, you know, we just have differences." And McCain, ironically, was booed by his own crowd. You know, I think that the McCain campaign, there is some division. On one hand, they do want to hit back at Barack Obama hard. They feel that the press hasn't been sort of examining sort of the attacks that Barack Obama has been leveling against McCain. But on one hand, there's a lot of people arguing that going negative, leveling all these attacks has diminished McCain as a brand.
Well, you know, I want to mention the Washington Post ABC News poll today. It's brand new, and it, by a margin of 59% to 35%, registered voters now say John McCain is more focused on attacking his opponent than on addressing the issues. But even if McCain and Palin pull back, the Republican Party emailed a new ad today focused on William Ayers. They call it guilt by participation. So are there some mixed messages here?
Definitely. There's no question. On one hand, you know, Senator McCain, one of the focuses was that they didn't want, the campaign did not want Senator McCain sort of having these attacks coming out of his mouth. They didn't want them associated with McCain. They wanted surrogates to do it. They wanted the party to do it. But the problem is that Senator McCain, at some of these town halls, people would say to him, you know, they would bring up William Ayers, and he would respond, and therefore, you know, it was him attacking. And so, you know, I just think overall, you know, like I said, there's a division within the campaign. People who want to have McCain sort of revert back to the kind of guy that people liked back in 2000 and even during this primary, a straight talker, a guy that wasn't going to run a campaign like this. But, you know, then on the other hand, you have advisors saying we need to hit back at Obama. So it's the sort of struggle that you're seeing within the McCain campaign with the Republican Party. You know, it's going to be interesting to watch for the next couple of weeks.
Right, or for the next couple of days. Both candidates will debate again on Wednesday. Holly Bailey, covering the Republican presidential campaign for Newsweek. Holly, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, today, economist Paul Krugman received the Nobel Prize for his analysis of free trade. Upon learning that he'd received the prize, Krugman said the current economic crisis resembles the Great Depression. Well, a full year ago, in a book that seems oddly prescient now, Krugman was already calling for a new deal. In The Conscience of a Liberal, Krugman argued that we have entered a new gilded age with runaway CEO salaries and a gap that stretched to a chasm between the rich and the poor. And he says the time is right for another great era of reform. When we spoke last October, I asked Paul Krugman to make his case.
Take a look at the typical family. Compare where the typical family is now with the way the typical family was in the early 1970s. Is that family better off, worse off? Well, you can actually make a case either way, and that's the point. If you look at the incomes up around 16% after you adjust for inflation, but that's because wives are working. A family that, you know, still tries to live with a single male breadwinner is about 14% poorer than it was in the early 70s. It's not clear that there's been a gain. And yet, think about, you know, those past 35 years. We're talking about personal computers. We're talking about the internet, fax machines becoming widespread, freight containerization. We used to have every ship unloaded by guys holding big bags of stuff, right? Mm. So we're a much more productive, much richer society than we were 35 years ago. And yet we're not sure. It's within the realm of argument whether the typical family is any better off. So where did it go? And the answer is, well, the incomes of the richest 1% of the population are up 150%.
150%?
Yeah. The incomes of CEOs are up 600%. It's an extraordinary increase in wealth at the top, which means there's been crumbs for most of the population.
You say that it's worse now than it was, you know, in the 20s. But you, as you well know, people will say to you, but, you know, people now, more people can, you know, even poor people can have a washing machine, or they can have, you know, some of the things we've come to expect that life will provide for us now.
Yeah, we're a much richer country than we were in the 1920s. We're a much richer country now than we were in the 1970s, and yet people are not clearly better off. And this notion that, well, it doesn't matter because everybody has enough. Were you watching TV during Hurricane Katrina? Mm. There are a lot of really poor people in this country, and even middle-class people are, many of them, are just one bad piece of news, one layoff, one illness away from real catastrophe. That's not the way it should be in the world's richest country.
You give an example of Microsoft founder Bill Gates walking into a bar that helps explain the differences.
Yeah. If Bill Gates walks into a bar, the average wealth in the bar is suddenly a couple of billion dollars. But that doesn't mean that the other people in the bar are any richer. And that's kind of a pretty good picture of what's happened to America these past 30 years. Average income is up, but it's just a few people.
Let's take a look at some of those salaries. You mentioned the CEO salaries much in the news lately. You know, give us some of the numbers there.
Well, if you go back, 60s, early 70s, CEOs earned 30 to 40 times as much as the average worker. We're in a situation now where CEOs are making 300 to 400 times the salary of the average worker.
In fact, you quote Michael Jensen, who's at Harvard Graduate School of Business, and who is credited or blamed. You know, he's the inventor of these huge CEO packages. The economic thinking was what? That if CEOs knew that, you know, that their pay was tied to performance, they'd do this incredible performance and it didn't matter how much they made.
That's right. One of the funny things is that the people who were arguing for higher CEO salaries also thought that politics was holding those salaries down, and what we needed to do was we needed to have stock options and things that would give CEOs the incentive to take risks. I think Michael Jensen wrote that, you know, if we pay them like bureaucrats, so they act like bureaucrats, so we should pay them like entrepreneurs. And of course, what it ends up is that they end up acting like riverboat gamblers.
Well, and we should say that Michael Jensen recently told the New York Times that, oops.
I think of him as Dr. Frankenstein. I've created a monster.
Well, anyway. He says he's writing a new book about how his idea went slightly askew, that people were being paid, getting the high pay, but without the performance. But what would you do if stockholders say it's okay, or if boards say it's okay? What would you say? Legislate that they can't make that much money?
No, it's actually interesting. On CEO salaries, what restrained them before? partly it was unions. So if if the government stops being an enemy of labor unions and becomes a friend again, that will make a big difference. Partly it was just public pressure. Congressmen would hold hearings to denounce excessive salaries. They don't do that anymore. If they did it again, there'd be a lot more restraint. Even Ronald Reagan called up the, if you read Barbarians at the Gates, Ronald Reagan was concerned that some of these entrepreneurs were making off with too much of the stockholders' money. So I don't think a legislative answer. It's just a change in the climate.
You mentioned the word political, and that's the second theme of your book, not just that there's this huge disparity, but that it has been caused by political decisions. Now, you know this is heresy for economists. They're supposed to be, as Adam Smith said, that invisible hand, market forces. You say no, political forces.
Yeah. Now, the evidence is pretty strong. If you go way back, you ask how did that middle-class society that baby boomers like me grew up in, how did it come into existence? The answer is quite suddenly. It was created politically by Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal.
We have some sound from Madison Square Garden, which was FDR's speech laying this thinking out. It was on the eve of the 1936 elections. Let's listen.
We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking, class antagonism, sectionalism, war profiteering. They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob.
FDR, on the eve of the 1936 election, he'd go on to, form Social Security, wage laws. He was called a traitor to his class, but he implemented these programs.
Yes, and he was a traitor to his class. Actually, if you were very rich, you ended up substantially less rich after FDR got through with you. But he created a much more decent society.
How was it taken from the rich and trickled down?
Oh, there were huge increases in taxes at the top, higher corporation taxes, minimum wage, a favorable environment for union building.
In fact, the federal government saw their role as helping unions.
That's right. And so you created a society in which working families had a much stronger bargaining position than they did before, than they do today.
President Eisenhower would write in 1954 to his brother, "Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor law and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our history. There's a splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things, but their number is negligible. And they are stupid."
Yeah. What happened was that FDR created these programs. He created a middle-class society, and people liked it. And the Republicans, after some electoral defeats, especially in 1948, decided to accept it. So Eisenhower went along. Eisenhower was not a big New Dealer, but he was willing to accept the achievements of the New Deal. The society we had by 1954, when he wrote that letter, was unimaginably better than the society we had had 25 years before.
That's economist Paul Krugman speaking to us a year ago about his book, Conscience of a Liberal. Today, he won the Nobel Prize for Economics. And by the way, he told us that that stupid splinter group Dwight Eisenhower spoke of eventually grew into a movement to dismantle the New Deal. Well, we also wondered, are all Americans a little at fault as well for believing maybe we could all be uber rich, so let's not tax the uber rich? We'll get the answer after a break. More with Paul Krugman in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Writing in the New York Times today, economist Paul Krugman praises Britain's response to the financial meltdown and says other wealthy nations are playing catch-up. The British government didn't buy bad assets in banks. They invested in banks, and now the British government is a major shareholder in three of the country's five big banks. Those banks will be required to lend more money to businesses and homeowners. Many top bank officials will leave, and there will be no cash bonuses for bank board members. Krugman wonders why this clear view of the crisis had to come from London, not Washington, even though the Bush administration is now considering also investing in American banks. Well, as you know, Paul Krugman won the Nobel Prize in Economics today, and we're rebroadcasting an interview we did with him last year about his book, The Conscience of a Liberal. That book focuses on a subject Krugman often writes about, the wage gap between rich and poor. He says that gap isn't caused by political forces, not market forces, specifically movement conservatism's attempt to decouple reconstruct the old New Deal. He writes that this movement, after capitulating to New Deal Democrats and moderate Republicans in the 50s, started a pushback in the early 60s with Barry Goldwater, and their first real victory was when Ronald Reagan became governor of California.
Yeah, they organized. They became an effective movement, what actually people inside it call movement conservatism, interlocking set of think tanks, media organizations, political groups. They took over the Republican Party, and they were able to win elections, but mostly not by campaigning on, you know, repealing the New Deal, although that was their goal, they themselves say that, but by running on other things, by exploiting racial tension, by exploiting national security, and so on.
You say they themselves say that. What would they say? I mean, how can you point to that?
Oh, you can find fundraising letters from the president of the Heritage Foundation where he says, never forget that our goal is to undo the New Deal and the Great Society, you know, Social Security and Medicare. Grover Norquist, everybody's favorite right-wing, Grover Norquist, the anti-tax advocate. Somebody once said that he's like a James Bond villain who likes to explain his evil plans to his victims. And he once said that he wants to bring America back to the way it was before Teddy Roosevelt and the socialists came in. So he wants to undo the 20th century.
Well, let's just take a couple of the things that seem to have been done, unions losing their strength, for instance. Couldn't you say, Paul Krugman, that in addition, or maybe instead of your thinking, it was actually the middle class that was born of the New Deal that helped destroy some of those things. So people sort of doing well, doing better, and pulling up the ladder behind them.
Well, there's some of that. People didn't think so much about how much these things mattered to them. Most, you know, white-collar workers weren't unionized and didn't feel to themselves that they needed it. But mostly, if you actually look at what happened to the union movement, it was union busting. The estimates are that at least 1 in 20 workers who voted for a union in the early 80s was fired. That's incredible.
But again, what would you do to change that? Would you suggest legislation? Because you call these things norms, things that have become accepted practice, much as they were during what you call the early Gilded Age of robber barons.
That's right. We are back in a period when, you know, we started to believe that great wealth is a sign of divine favor and personal virtue. But, you know, let's put practical policy is going to be about things like labor law and about tax rates. So I believe that norms can make a big difference. But first thing to do is to restore some progressivity to the tax system, to start enforcing the labor law we have and expanding it, not these things.
What about wages?
The minimum wage has proved to be a very effective tool for establishing some norms, among other things, in the workplace. And we allowed it to erode. Until this most recent legislation, the minimum wage was back down to levels of circa 1950 once you adjusted for inflation. So you can raise the minimum wage. And above all, the social safety net. Having good health insurance is a prerequisite for being middle class. Only in America, among rich countries, is that something that everyone doesn't have.
Might one of the problems be that when FDR implemented his New Deal, this was a class society. You could not move between classes. And now, the people that you're talking to who may not even know how much their middle class status has been eroded, they look at a rapper or a sports star and they think they could be that 1% that's super rich. And
I'm really glad you said that, because it turns out there was actually a lot of social mobility, a lot of chance to move up or down, but a lot of chance to move around in classes.
Was there that perception, though? I mean, was the perception, though, that it was?
Oh, yeah, it was. Remember, Horatio Alger is an early 20th century author. Huh. The amazing thing now is that if you really look at the international evidence, Horatio Alger has moved to Europe. The ability of people to move up in economic status has been declining in the United States and is definitely lower than it is in most other countries.
What else might give you hope that this is a time for a new deal?
So much. Again, when I wrote Conscience of a Liberal, I didn't think I was going to end up here, but it turns out that just looking at the voting numbers, at the political science studies, so much of what has happened in the United States really represents race. Republicans began winning more votes in presidential elections. That's entirely because Southern whites switched parties.
And Southern whites switched parties because the Democrats who had overseen
right.
Jim Crow took up civil rights as
That's right. As LBJ told Bill Moyers when they passed the Civil Rights Act, the South will now be Republican for my lifetime and yours. And the politicians knew that. Ronald Reagan began his 1980 campaign by going to Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the civil rights workers were murdered, and giving a speech in favor of states' rights. He didn't say any, you know, bad words, but everybody got the message. You know, the welfare queen with the Cadillac.
Right. A perception that the New Deal was a deal for slaggards and minorities and people who weren't pulling their weight.
That's right. It was for those people. And just in general, they got the votes of people who felt that they were being exploited. Ronald Reagan, with the endless harping on welfare cheats, of which there was never very much evidence, that's central to the appeal of these policies. And even so, people never bought into it. When there have been really two attempts to dismantle Social Security, one under Reagan, one under Bush. Both times, the public basically said, heck no, we like that program.
If there's one criticism of your book, it is that it is such a screed against Republicans for the reasons you've laid out. But you don't lay any blame at the feet of the Democrats, especially in recent years, with the mandates that they've had in elections. Does some of this responsibility lay at their feet, especially from here on for the next couple of years if that mandate continues?
Well, right now, you're looking at people are enormously frustrated over the Democrats' timidity on the war, on national security issues. And it's, I'm pretty upset, too. Give the Democrats a Democratic White House. Let's see if they deliver.
That's Paul Krugman, who was named today winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. We spoke with him last October about his book, The Conscience of a Liberal. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, if they were kind of shaky on Wall Street, they were trembling on Tryon Street in Charlotte, North Carolina. We'll take a look at how that city is reacting to its shifting corporate pillars. Also, Pakistan at war on its border with Afghanistan and in a nuclear standoff with its other neighbor, India. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, you're free to go. No, you're not. The legal limbo of the Chinese Uyghurs at Guantanamo Bay. Back after the news, Here and Now. John McCain and Barack Obama agree on at least one issue. They both want to close the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. Well, the latest legal battle over Guantanamo could stretch into one of their administrations. It involves 17 Chinese Muslims, known as Uyghurs, who've been held at the Cuban prison since 2001, even though the Bush administration acknowledges they are not enemy combatants. Last week, a federal judge ruled the government must release the men to the U.S., where they would be taken in by members of the Uyghur community living here. But the Justice Department appealed, and the D.C. Federal Appeals Court put a stay on the release. The Uyghurs at Guantanamo are represented by lawyers from the Boston firm of Bingham McCutcheon. Neil McGarrigan is part of that legal team. Neil, did the Uyghurs think they were going to be released? Did they have a reaction to this stay of their release?
We did have an opportunity to get word to them the day that the judge ordered their release. We then, the very next day, had to report to them that the stay had entered and that wasn't going to be happening.
And obviously they must be disappointed.
Disappointed is an understatement, yeah. But, this is not the first time they have been told they were going to be released. I think from their perspective, this is just more of the same.
Well, walk us through this. These men were picked up in Afghanistan in 2001. The U.S. government claimed they'd been training at camps sponsored by the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. This is a group the Bush administration designated a terrorist organization after the men were detained. But tell us a little bit about that, because that becomes key. East Turkestan Islamic Movement. The Uyghurs, who come from a Chinese province, they refer to that province as East Turkestan. They are a breakaway Chinese group.
That's correct. They come from Xinjiang province, and for years they have been under the pretty brutal yoke of oppression by the Chinese Communist government and have sought greater autonomy from Beijing.
And, of course, the Chinese government would say that they are a terrorist breakaway group.
The Chinese government certainly has identified parts of the Uyghur population in China as terrorists and have made a campaign out of it and I think have, in fact, relied on the post-9/11 era to really trump that up and have made all sorts of allegations about the Uyghurs. But most of them, as far as we can tell, appear to be just propaganda from the Chinese government.
So now many of these men end up at Guantanamo Bay after being picked up in Afghanistan. Again, the Bush administration saying they were training at what they labeled a terrorist training camp. Now the federal government says the Uyghurs are no longer considered enemy combatants. Why? What changed?
Honestly, nothing has changed. In fact, the government had determined as early as 2003 and 2004 for most of these men that they were not enemy combatants. So this is really old news as far as the government is concerned, and it has been trying ever since then to find a safe place to relocate the Uyghurs from Guantanamo. Notwithstanding that the military and Department of Defense knew they were noncombatants, these men were put through combatant status review tribunals. More recently, what has happened is that we were able to get the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to officially rule that one of our clients, Huzaifa Parhat, is a non-combatant and that there was no evidence on which he could be held as an enemy combatant. Since that time, the government has conceded that all the Uyghurs are essentially the same, factually, as Huzaifa Farhad, and so the military and the Department of Justice agreed that each one of them should now be considered a non-combatant officially.
Well, that brings us to the bind that the U.S. seems to see now. You said that the problem has been finding a safe place for them to go. The U.S. may not see them as enemy combatants, but China does. Is that why they can't be returned to China?
Yeah, the fear is that if they're returned to China, they will be treated extremely harshly and, you know, tortured, imprisoned, potentially worse. So the U.S. government has committed itself not to return the men to China, and we're confident that they won't be sent there. And that has left the U.S. with two alternatives, either find a safe place for them or bring them to the United States.
Well, five of the men were previously released to Albania. Other countries won't take them in because they don't want to get into a conflict with China. First of all, why can't these remaining men go to Albania?
We don't know the status of negotiations between the United States and Albania or any other country for that matter. They have made, you know, general assertions that our government has been trying to place them with as many as 100 countries, but has been unable to. But they won't tell us the specifics of their negotiations with any particular country. So I don't know why Albania is not an option. It was not a great option in the first place, but it was certainly better than Guantanamo.
Well, and why is the U.S. Justice Department saying they can't come to the U.S.? If there are Uyghur families, stable families in a community in Washington, D.C., and the government no longer sees them as enemy combatants, why can't they come to the U.S.?
It's astounding, really. And honestly, our government, frankly, should be ashamed. You know, one of the real reason is that the Bush administration has spent so many years painting Guantanamo as a place where hardened killers are held to keep the United States and its allies safe. And the reality of who's at Guantanamo is that you have Uyghurs there who are non-combatants and have always been non-combatants. When you release those men into the United States and they move into communities and live next door to ordinary Americans who look and say, really, this is who we've been keeping in Guantanamo? The entire myth of what Guantanamo is about is shattered. And that is the reason I think that the administration has been so horribly stubborn about releasing these men into the United States. It knows they're not a security risk, but it can't stand the public relations disaster of spoiling the myth that it's been trying to create about Guantanamo for all these years.
By the way, have any of these Uyghurs admitted that they were training at the East Turkestan Islamic Movement camps in Afghanistan, perhaps to launch attacks on China?
No, again, this is, I think, you know, hysteria by the government. It was a village. They happened to be Uyghur people who lived there. There were no Al-Qaeda. There were no Taliban. There was nobody but Uyghurs who lived in this village. There was one gun at the camp that they learned how to clean and disassemble and reassemble, but they didn't even have bullets, so they couldn't shoot. All of the language that the government has used has been couched in terms like Tora Bora and training camps and the Taliban, and none of that is really an accurate description of what these men were doing. Now, that said, they have all said they are not friends of the Chinese government. They have also said that they love the United States and have held up the United States as a sort of beacon of hope and freedom. So the administration's treatment of them has been really abominable in light of what we know about these men.
Well, here we have the U.S. government not wanting them to come to the U.S. Could another possibility for that be that here we are in this huge financial crisis, at the center of it, China, in that the U.S. and China have, you know, huge financial ties now? Could it be that the U.S. government doesn't want to insult China as opposed to doesn't want people to see, you know, people who were held at Guantanamo?
I don't think so. And here's why. The U.S. is already insulting China by not returning these men to China and going out of its way to find any other country besides China to return these men to. So admitting them to the United States is really no different from keeping them at Guantanamo in terms of our relationship with China. So, no, I don't think that's a viable explanation at all.
Neil McGarrigan is a lawyer with the Boston law firm Bingham McCutcheon. He represents a group of Chinese Muslims known as Uyghurs who are being held at Guantanamo Bay. Neil, we know there's going to be a whole set of appeals now that will take place on the part of the government and your firm representing these men. How long do you think this is going to take?
It's likely to take months at least for the appeal to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. And that, I'm sure, will last well into the beginning of the next administration. After that, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see this case elevated to the next level of appeal to the United States Supreme Court, which could take more than a year after that. So I think we're likely looking at 18 months to 2 years before this is all over.
Neil McGarrigan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this one quick note, it could happen sooner than that. The White House has said the reason the Bush administration appealed the court order to release the Uyghurs is the feeling that the only the president has the power to order the release of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The White House did not say if the president would use that power to order the release of the 17 Chinese men. We'll continue to follow this story. You're listening to Here and Now. If you ever visit Mammoth Cave in central Kentucky, you might want to ask Jerry Bransford to be your guide. You'll get an excellent tour of the Underground National Park, and as producer Rachel Pace learned, you'll also hear stories that go almost as far back as the caves themselves.
There's a strong wind blowing today at the historic entrance to Mammoth Cave, so tour guide Jerry Bransford quickly ushers me in and shuts the large metal door behind us. 61-year-old Jerry Bransford has been a national park guide here for the past 5 years. He spends the better part of his day hundreds of feet below the surface of the earth, in a limestone labyrinth that stretches 365 miles beneath a ridgeline in central Kentucky. Jerry took this job after retiring from the nearby Dow Corning plant. He says he was always meant to be here. After all, his family has been leading tours of Mammoth Cave for 5 generations.
There was Matt Matterson. He had Henry had Lewis, John Henry, my grandfather, Charles Wesley, and the second Matt, third generation.
And John Henry had David, and David had Jerry, completing a cycle that began in 1838 when a slave owner named Franklin Gorin bought the Kentucky Caves for $5,000. His plan was to lure tourists to what we now know to be the largest cave system in the world. Gorin brought with him a slave of his own, Stephen Bishop, and 2 leased slaves, one called Nick, and the other Jerry Bransford's great-great-grandfather, Matt.
I can feel him and hear him. I don't know if he can. And when I was a youngster, I got up in age, something quietly said, it's left up to me. I've got to come back here and tell what I can find out and fill in the gaps. I get to walk down the same path where they travel. Hey, I get to step right there where they stood, you know? I can't tell you how that makes me feel.
By day, Stephen Bishop and the elder Bransfords led tours. By night, they explored. Hiking, crawling, climbing through vast pits and domes. Other times, barely squeezing through tiny openings where no human had gone before. Jerry leads me down one path so narrow we have to stoop and turn sideways to get through.
I think Stephen was the first one here, and it was once named the Winding Way. And so he renamed it Tall Man's Agony and Fat Man's Misery, which is a trace of the water flow quite swiftly through here. Yeah. And they said he was on his belly clearing out the mud and the silt. And when he finally got into the end, he says, oh, what a relief it is to stand up. And the end of it's named Great Relief Hall.
Listening to Jerry Bransford's stories, it's easy to forget that these voracious young men were tied by the chains of slavery. They loved the caves, but they yearned for freedom. And for some, like Nick, the caves offered a way out.
He knew that Stephen was the first one down there, and Stephen was getting good tips, catching those eyeless shrimp out of the cave water, so Nick would go down there and dip his hat in the water. And I take that those things were quite plentiful, so he was catching those things pretty easy, maybe getting 50 cents or a dollar for those things in the 1850s, you know, a lot of money.
Enough money, Jerry says, for Nick to buy his freedom.
And he went back to his hometown of Glasgow, our hometown, but he only stayed gone a year. So he got into the barn lots in Hayfield, and he realized that just because you had a document that says you're free didn't mean that people out there treated you that way. So he came back.
Jerry believes there's another pull that drew Nick back to Mammoth Cave, the same one that kept generations of Bransfords here for 170 years.
They were in charge.
Jerry tells me the story of a daring rescue in the 1850s when his ancestors led a senator from Ohio and other visitors to safety. Waters from an underground river were starting to rise and flood the cave, and the tourists, in complete darkness, were panicking.
He says, follow these boys' instructions to the letter, or we shall all perish. Wouldn't that be a great feeling, to be a slave guide and a senator? And they was usually well-to-do people. Well-to-do people may not be so nice up there, or they could be, but when they come down here, they depend on you. Not a bad feeling now. I can only imagine how it must have felt in the 1850s. I'm in charge.
Coming for to carry me home.
I came from a family of singers, and Matt used to sing in a cave. They would go down to the river and sing and entertain, and the voices would echo through the cavern down there. Sometimes I sing an old song for a little bit.
Sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Our story on Mammoth Cave Guide Jerry Bransford was produced by Rachel Paste. Well, coming up, until he performed it, everyone sang the national anthem the same way. That's in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. Baseball is in the air. Here in Boston, the Tampa Bay Rays meet the Red Sox this afternoon at Fenway Park. They're tied at one game each in the American League Championship Series. In the National League, the Philadelphia Phillies play the Los Angeles Dodgers tonight. Philadelphia leads that series 2-1. Now, one of the rituals before each game, of course, will be the singing of the national anthem. For the most part, the anthem is sung. Attention quickly turns to baseball. But 40 years ago, a young performer created an uproar. Doug Tribou of NPR's Only a Game has this story.
The 1968 World Series pitted the Detroit Tigers against the defending champions, the St. Louis Cardinals. Legendary Detroit play-by-play man Ernie Harwell moonlighted as a songwriter in the 1960s. Because of his musical talents, the Tigers' front office asked him to pick the performers who would sing the national anthem before games 3, 4, and 5 of the series at Tiger Stadium. Harwell's choice for game 3 was Detroit native Margaret Whiting, who did a traditional version.
And for the second game, I picked Marvin Gaye. And one of the ironies of the whole situation was that the Tigers asked me to go to Marvin Gaye and ask him not to sing the song in a non-traditional way. And he agreed, and he sang it pretty straight. And the third choice was Jose Feliciano.
Jose Feliciano has recorded dozens of albums in both English and Spanish. His Christmas song, Feliz Navidad, is ubiquitous between Thanksgiving and New Year's. But in 1968, he was a newcomer, and his cover of The Doors song, Light My Fire, was a hit.
There's no time to wallow in the mire.
On October 7th, 1968, 23-year-old Jose Feliciano played the Star Spangled Banner at Tiger Stadium, strumming an acoustic guitar while he sang.
Oh, can you see by the dawn?
So 1968 was a turbulent time for the nation. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy had been assassinated. The country was at war in Vietnam. And Detroit was still recovering from the 1967 riots that left more than 40 dead and 2,000 buildings burned to the ground. Feliciano says many people assumed his version of the anthem was meant to convey a political message, but that was not his intention.
My feeling at the time was it was my way of thanking America for the great opportunities that I had been given. The fact that a Puerto Rican kid could become successful. I love this country, and as far as I'm concerned, it's the greatest country in the world.
Harwell escorted Feliciano, who has been blind since birth, and his seeing eye dog off the field.
And he asked me on the way toward the stands, how did I do? I said, I think you did fine. And I was surprised by the reaction, and the New York Times had a front page picture of Jose singing, and which was rather unusual for the Times in those days. Now, the Tigers got quite a few letters, and I got about 500-and-something letters, and most of them were against, but there was a good representation of pro-letters among the group.
Tigers outfielder Willie Horton says Feliciano's performance caught the players, including Detroit pitcher Mickey Lolich, off guard. But Horton also considered it the team's good luck charm.
I remember Lolich looked and said, wow, what, wow. We never heard anything like that, but I think you could feel something. It got the fans ready for the game, and which we needed. I just look at it back at that time, it was a turning point. To me, a lot of electricity was going through the fans.
St. Louis had taken a 3-1 lead in the series. The Tigers won Game 5 and then beat the Cardinals twice more in St. Louis to clinch the title. The New York Times reported that NBC received hundreds of complaints from television viewers who saw Feliciano's performance. Some commentators called the version Baby Light My Flag, playing off Feliciano's success with Light My Fire. Looking back, Feliciano says he's proud to be the first to take an unusual approach to the national anthem.
Or during that whole era of the 60s, the anthem was sung very traditional, and the people who went to the ball game were very bored with it, and they couldn't wait till whoever sang it got to the end so they could get on with the game. And I thought this was unconscionable, that this was horrible.
Feliciano's rendition came 10 months before Jimi Hendrix performed his now famous version at Woodstock. Despite, or maybe because of the controversy, Feliciano's was the first to make it to the charts as a single, but he says the uproar hurt his career.
Radio stations all over the country stopped playing my records, even though I won Grammys that year. From 1968 to 1973, I was gone from the airwaves.
Ernie Harwell, now 90 years old, says Feliciano's World Series performance is still his favorite version of the song.
It was a soul rendition, all right. It had a lot of feeling. It had some blues in it. But I never thought it was denigrating in any way, like a lot of people did.
Jose Feliciano is still performing and recording albums. He says despite the controversy, given another chance, he would still sing it the same way.
I think America is one of those countries that is willing to say, hey, you know what? We were wrong. This is not right. Let's change it. And so that's why I love America. That's why I did the national anthem. And I will always be a patriot. And nobody can ever say about Jose Feliciano that he's un-American.
Jose Feliciano speaking to Doug Tribou of NPR's Only a Game. Well, earlier today, we reprised a conversation we had with columnist Paul Krugman, who today won the Nobel Prize in Economics. Krugman said what the economy needs today is New Deal programs like the ones FDR instituted. Well, that segment left us wanting to hear a little more FDR, specifically President Roosevelt's explanation of his bank holiday, his decision to close and audit every bank in America after billions of depositor dollars vanished in the bank failures of 1933. Here is an excerpt of his fireside chat.
First of all, let me state the simple fact that when you deposit money in a bank, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault. It invests your money in many different forms of credit, in bonds and commercial paper and mortgages and in many other kinds of loans. A comparatively small part of the money that you put into the bank is kept in currency, an amount which in normal times is fully sufficient to cover the cash needs of the average citizen. What then happened during the last few days of February and the first few days of March? We have had a bad banking situation. Some of our bankers have shown themselves either incompetent or dishonest in their handling of the people's funds. They had used the money entrusted to them in speculations and unwise loans. And so it became the government's job to straighten out this situation, and to do it as quickly as possible, and that job is being performed. I can never be sufficiently grateful to the people for the loyal support, even though all our processes may not have seemed clear to them. After all, there is an element in the readjustment of our financial system, more important than currency, more important than gold, and that is the confidence of the people themselves. You people must have faith. You must not be stampeded by rumors or guesses. Let us unite in banishing fear.
An excerpt of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's fireside chat on the banking crisis of 1933. We'll have the whole broadcast at our website, here-now.org. And, of course, we'll continue to cover the banking crisis of 2008. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.